You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hey, everybody. The Other People podcast is offered freely. All episodes of this program, more than 550 episodes and counting, are all available for free. Your support makes a difference. If you would like to support this show, you can do so at patreon.com/otherpplpod. Thanks.
You are not alone. You have found other people.
You and I have a friend in common.
Every stupid thing that a writer could do, I've done.
I think it's really beautiful.
Jeez, what a struggle, you know?
It was incredible. You know, it was like your head exploded seeing what was really there.
And now here's your host, Brad Listy.
Just one person.
Hi, everybody. How's it going? Hello. This is the Other People podcast. I'm Brad Listy. I'm in Los Angeles. I have a bit of a cold. I don't know if you can hear it in my voice. I'm a bit congested. I could sneeze at any moment. But otherwise, I'm feeling good. I have John Ray on the program. He is a Whiting Award winner. He's won a Guggenheim. He's published many critically acclaimed works of fiction. His latest novel is called Godsend. It's available from Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. And we had a great time talking. He came over on a Friday evening, if I'm recalling correctly. We had a bourbon or two, and we got down to it. He's a wonderful talker and a good guy and an excellent writer, and that conversation is coming up in just a second. Before I get there, I want to say just a quick thank you for the kind notes that I received over the course of the past week regarding the new partnership with LitHub. For those of you who did not listen to the last episode, my conversation with Christopher Zeisheg, the Other People podcast has in effect been syndicated by LitHub.com. So they will be, posting the show and some excerpts or transcripts of certain bits of the show, and they'll be talking about it on their social channels and on their email newsletter. But it's a new partnership, and it's a way for the show to reach a new audience, and excited about it and very grateful to you guys for the good cheer. So without any further ado, let's get to the show. This is my conversation with John Ray. His new novel, One More Time, is called Godsend.
On my dad's side, my family's, you know, been in California forever, really since the gold rush. We didn't make any money during the gold rush other than to open a saloon in Placerville, California, which in those days was not called Placerville. In those days, Placerville was called Hangtown.
Where's Placerville?
It's up on the border to Nevada. Basically, if you drove due east from the Bay Area all the way...
Like to Reno?
Almost to Reno, yeah.
Like Truckee and the Sierra?
Yeah, absolutely. Way up in the Sierras, but still in California, but right sort of almost across the border.
So your family, and it was called Hangtown?
Yeah, the town was called Hangtown then. It was a mining town, founded, I think, in 49. And by the time these two brothers, who were, distant ancestors of mine, got there, they had a claim, but there was just no more gold to be found. You know, all the claims were tapped out by that point. They were probably 5-10 years too late. You know, these gold rushes went very fast. They got there and they were smart enough to realize there was no more gold to be found, but there was still a lot of people there looking for gold, and none of those people had very much to do with their time, and enough of them had some money to spend that clearly the thing to do was to open up a saloon. So that's what these two brothers did, and then they did pretty well.
Wow. So, that's an impressive amount of knowledge about your ancestors. That's 1849?
Yeah. Well, this was 1856, I believe.
How do you know all this?
Because I was fortunate enough to have an aunt who was a very brilliant woman, but someone who never really found a means of kind of exercising her intelligence. You know, she was a housewife, mother of three kids. So at some point, relatively late in life, she's one of these people who really became passionately interested in genealogy.
Like 23andMe?
I mean, Ancestry. Unfortunately, she didn't live to see 23andMe. That would have, of course, fascinated her no end. I'm sure she would love all this stuff that's happening now. You know, freaky as it is, I'm sure she would find it fascinating. But she just, you know, she was researching the old-fashioned way, just going to archives and libraries and looking through court records. And, you know, she spent decades putting together this sort of mosaic that more or less tells the story of our family from Scotland. Apparently we're descended from horse thieves in Scotland who were arrested by the English.
My last name means thief in some like obscure Mediterranean dialect.
Is that right?
I mean, I say that with like partial confidence because I used to live when I was just out of college in a basement apartment and my upstairs neighbor and landlord was Greek.
Uh-huh.
Parents like lived in Greece. He was over here for like law school. And he was, you know, amused that I was like Sicilian, or my last name is Sicilian. And he one night knocked on my door and had a book in his hands, and it was like some sort of like Mediterranean dialect book. And he pointed to my name,
and there you read the word thief.
That's right.
I think we have this sort of collective mythology in the United States, which would have us believe that, you know, most Americans came here because they were highly principled members of an oppressed religious minority that was seeking greater freedom for its beliefs. And obviously that does play a part in the early history of the United States. But I often think that we in the U.S. aren't that different from a country like Australia. I mean, or any of the Spaniards who initially came to the New World, you know, and then settled Mexico or parts of South America. You don't leave your home unless you have a pretty good reason. And usually that reason is an economic one or a legal one.
Yeah. There's like a desperation.
Yeah.
Either way. Like that's what I think. Like there's something innate in the American character that is desperate.
Yeah. And I think that's true.
Or is that just human? And I think
anyone who migrates any significant distance from their place of birth must have some sort of desperation in them.
Yeah.
And that's not necessarily a bad thing. That can lead to all sorts of interesting events.
No, I think it's like the engine in a way. You need that kind of energy.
Yeah.
Like you don't want human suffering, but like, I do think that like the energy of wanting to create a new life and escape some sort of difficult situation, like you said, I think it can, I don't know. I feel like that's like one of the big tragedies of the era that we're living through now, is that we're closing our doors to all of that human energy coming in and all of that new blood. And yeah, I don't know. I think that's it's a huge strength.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you can also flip that and say that one of the greatest dangers to any, society, when it closes itself off, is this risk of complacency and stagnation, you know, and a kind of almost sort of incestuous approach to one's own culture and society. And I mean, it's not for nothing that one of the fundamental tenets of the theory of natural selection has to do with what's known as hybrid vigor, which is an established scientific fact, which is that when you combine very disparate gene pools, just on a genetic level, and hybridize those two populations, the resulting offspring are hardier and usually better equipped to survive.
So like my street mutt?
Absolutely.
Twiggy is like going to be hopefully a hardy soul?
Absolutely. I mean, dogs are a perfect example of this. Any type of mongrel dog is generally healthier. I mean, think about all the people who have these pure breeds that they've spent enormous amounts of money on, who all develop some sort of genetic complication. You know, they have a problem with their hips, or they, you know, all of these purebred dogs seem to develop some sort of problem.
We almost got a doodle.
Oh, yeah.
Because my wife's got some allergies. And, like, we looked at it, and I was like, eh. Like, it can be tempting because you bioengineer, basically.
Yeah.
So it doesn't shed.
Sure. There's but human beings are very clumsy at bioengineering, really, when you get right down to it. We've had a lot of success with it over the years. You know, we've shaped dogs into something that they weren't originally intended to be. I mean, if you can speak of intention with these things. But, you know, there are always side effects. There are always undesired outcomes that are kind of built into these desirable traits that we want. You know, we're just, it's pretty clumsy, you know, like
I want
a dog that's smaller than the dog that we have. So we're going to look for the smallest dogs of the litter. We're going to, you know, put them together and hope that a smaller dog results, you know, and that often works quite well, but who knows what other traits you're messing with. I mean, genetics are very complicated.
Well, we used to have a French bulldog, Walter, who choked on a bagel, unfortunately, and passed away.
I'm sorry to hear that.
Yeah. But he, you know, French bulldogs were invented, I think, in the late 19th century in, I want to say, France, where they took English bulldogs and they bred the smallest, like they basically found dwarves who had like the recessive gene where the ears popped up. See what I'm saying? Like it's like science fiction. They did this, and these dogs, they have to be birthed through cesarean section because they, you know, they're so like, you know, there's just there's just a lot that goes into it, and they do have lots of health problems typically.
Yeah. I thought you were going to say they took a population of English bulldogs and they just bred them for arrogance. And suddenly they ended up with some French bulldogs.
Well, they became good companion dogs. They were small enough to sort of like sit in your lap. Like,
oh, they're incredibly cute.
But they can't do much with them.
And I don't think they can breathe very well.
No.
Don't they have breathing issues?
Yeah. It's called brachiocephalic, the flat faced dogs.
Right.
So they snort and they snore.
Yeah.
I mean, I've always been a guy, like, I mean, at least in my adult life, I've had active dogs. I have Twiggy now, and then I had a border collie. Before that, and that's like the French bulldog in the middle was sort of an experiment in having more of like a furniture dog. They just like lie there.
It's probably dangerous to talk about dog breeds like this in a podcast because you're going to alienate somebody somewhere.
You know, how many people
there'll be a passionate believer, a lover of French bulldogs somewhere who.
I don't dislike French bulldogs. I'm just saying it's a different experience.
Yeah. For the record, they're very cute.
They're very cute. I don't trust, like I was going to say, when you were talking about humans and bioengineering, you know, you talk about like cloning shit and bringing, you know, there's talk of like bringing back the woolly mammoth and like some of that stuff sounds kind of cool. But when we start to get into this, I just don't trust us as a species to handle these responsibilities.
I don't really trust us as a species to handle any responsibility. I'm really trying to think of a responsibility that we've been entrusted with that we've handled well so far.
Yeah, we're a mess.
Yeah. I mean, I guess we've gotten pretty good at cooking.
Well, it's like we're clever. I think human beings are clever, but I think that, like, you know, I talked earlier about like America having this inherent desperation. There's just something very fallible and corrupted about the way we're wired.
Yes. Well, we're far cleverer than we are wise. You know?
That's right.
I think that's essentially, there's just an asymmetry there and a disproportion there. I mean, we're just a bunch of precocious children.
Do you think we're going to, like, what's going to happen? Are we on our way out?
I think there's going to be an enormous cataclysmic correction. I don't think we're going to become extinct anytime soon, but often when there have been massive upheavals, ecologically speaking, if you go back through the sort of natural record, actually it's fairly rare that a species will go completely extinct, at least if it's reached a certain population kind of globally. It's very hard to wipe out every last member of a species, you know, but there are often these enormous corrections that result in a far, far slimmer pie wedge than originally existed, you know. They often have found when, for example, a new species is introduced to, let's say a new species of rat is introduced to some island in the Pacific. Sometimes that can really lead to the full extinction of native species, but usually there's a tremendous period of upheaval and then equilibrium is restored again. And there's just a lot less of a certain species or of all the species, you know, there's a redistribution. And I tend to think that that is what will happen with humanity over the next few hundred years, but I don't know. I mean, I guess, you know, in a weird way, things have become so dark lately that what I just said is kind of an optimistic take on the future, which is kind of amazing. You know, if you told me this when I was, you know, 12 years old and in the 80s, you know, I would have been pretty shocked.
Yeah.
But the other thing about humans is we can get used to anything. You know, we're very good at becoming dissatisfied with things that should probably render us content. And that's a big part of our problem now, I think, as a species. But we can also get used to anything, no matter how horrible, you know, that explains a lot of relationships.
Yeah, that too. Yeah, it does. I was talking about that in the context of like the homelessness problem in California.
Sure.
You know, just like getting used to seeing people sleeping in their own filth in the street.
Yeah.
And just
these tent cities now that have sprung up.
Yeah, like what we were tolerating this and just like accepting it as normal and as like the only, you know, just the way things have to be or something. Like it's somehow intractable. And it just
or the natural order of things.
Yeah, and it bums me out. And like, you know, it's be useful for people to go places where this isn't an issue.
Absolutely.
And to like walk around and ask yourself why.
Yeah.
Like why? I don't know the answer. Like why when you go to, you know, Berlin or something, that's not as, it's not as evident. Not that you know, these places are perfect, but.
No, not at all. I mean, it's interesting. I live in Mexico now. I live in Mexico City. My girlfriend, who's from Mexico and has lived her whole life in Mexico City, pointed out to me at some point, not too long ago, that there are virtually no homeless people in Mexico. And that is actually true. There are far, far fewer homeless people in Mexico than in the United States. And the reason for that is obviously not that Mexico is some utopia in which the poor are somehow taken care of by the state. Or, you know, there's greater equity among the population in terms of wealth and various other things. It's simply that culturally in Mexico, family, and especially one's extended family, is far more important than it is in the United States, which means if you have even a second cousin who somehow can't find a way to make his way on his own through the world, you find a place for that person. You know, you take that person in. If they're an alcoholic, if they're schizophrenic, the family will find some way of accommodating that person for better or for worse. Whereas in the United States, that's simply not the case.
See, this is where like, you know, all that, like I'm pretty liberal in my politics, but this is where I find myself saying things that sound like of the right, like family values, the social fabric, the way that's been like sort of diminished or fractalized or whatever. Like, I think it's actually to our detriment.
Well, I think it brings advantages with it, but carries great disadvantages as well.
And it doesn't necessarily have to be biological. It's just like that sense of human community and this
community,
care for one another and a feeling of authentic connection.
Yeah.
And like responsibility to one another. Like some of that's been lost. I mean, you live in a city like Los Angeles. I don't know where all you've lived or if it's like this in Mexico City, but I think bigger cities might make it easier to sort of blend in, be anonymous, kind of feel disconnected from people because it's so big and there's so many people and everybody's in a hurry.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've lived here almost 20 years. I've known a few of my neighbors, like only one of them like became like a real friend.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it's like friendly at best.
It is very odd. And that is, I think, a great change that's happened even just in the last sort of generation or two or three. I certainly notice in Mexico City when I walk down the street, people greet me with whom I've never spoken. You know, they've seen me around often enough to register that I somehow, you know, have some connection to the block. And really, I think everyone on my block will you know, just say hello to me on, you know, and I've learned to do that. It took me a while to overcome my sort of innate American reserve and respond in kind in a natural way that didn't seem forced.
You speak Spanish?
I do, yeah.
Fluently?
Pretty fluently.
That's good.
It's getting there.
Did you learn because of your girlfriend, or did you know it before?
I studied in Spanish in high school, which didn't help me at all. I'd graduate from high school without barely being able to ask, you know, what time the bus leaves. Then I lived in Texas for quite a while near the border and spent time in Mexico then in my 20s. But certainly having spent the last 2 years down in Mexico City and really just being in situations in which it wasn't an option to sort of lame out on it and be lazy.
Well, immersion's the best way, right?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, and by immersion, I think one has to specify a situation in which you have no escape.
Yeah.
You speak the language or you keep your mouth shut.
That's right.
That you just have to be forced to do it because, you know, we're all lazy. We don't want to do unnecessary work.
But it does get old. Like, I've been in situations like that where I made like I wasn't there long enough to make the advance to fluency, but you're lazy, but you also quickly get tired of being like two-dimensional in conversation.
Yeah.
It really sucks to not have language.
Yeah.
So especially as like a writerly person or somebody who like values like being able to like be expressive and, communicate. It's just,
it's incredibly frustrating. That's right. As a verbal person and someone who values good conversation, which you of course do, or you wouldn't be doing this podcast.
Right.
It is very frustrating. And expressed this to my best and at the time pretty much my only friend down in Mexico City, the Chilean writer Alejandro Zambra, who's a brilliant writer. If you haven't ever read him, you really have to read his stuff. But I said to him, God, you know, sometimes I just feel so stupid. I just feel so much stupider when I'm speaking Spanish. And he just sort of looked at me and said, well, you are stupider. And he really, that's how he understands intelligence. You know, if you are unable to express a sophisticated thought, then you might as well essentially not be having that thought in terms of communication, you know. And he firmly believes that in languages that you don't speak well, you truly are less intelligent than you would be in a language that you fully have mastered.
That makes sense.
It's a very sort of pragmatic way of looking at things. But what that means, of course, is that if you choose to live in a country in which a language is spoken that you are not fluent in, you really are accepting an enormous handicap. Yeah. You're basically saying, I'm okay with being a little bit dumber than everyone around me.
Like, the way I would put it is, like, it feels like you're less, you exist less.
Yeah, it's a like flattening, as you said.
Yeah, it's not like a complete existence. You can't, I mean, like, you realize, like, that's such a, integral part of being. To be able to just shoot the shit with somebody.
On the other hand, it carries unexpected benefits, I think. I tend to, I think, talk more than I should. And in an environment in which I'm not fully fluent in the language, I shut up and I listen a lot more and I pay a lot more attention to things and I become much more of a passionate and committed observer. And I think I never really realized how much I was missing out on before I found myself in a situation in which I was silent most of the time.
Yeah.
And that carries great pleasures with it.
Yeah, it's good for writing too, I think.
It's very good for writing, but they're not the kind of obvious pleasures that one might think of when one thinks of sort of social pleasures. It was very unexpected for me. And I really think as a result, though you might not know it right now, I speak less even when I'm in the U.S. than I used to, and listen more.
That doesn't surprise me. I mean, like, I mean, if you're enjoying it, and also I think, you know, anything that you do often enough ingrains itself. Mm-hmm. It's like practice.
If the company is good, it can be one of the greatest pleasures just to sit back and listen.
Yeah. Well, and like also, I feel like when you're living someplace that's not your home turf,
mm-hmm.
it makes you, I don't know, you have a different charge to you.
Yeah.
Like walking around, I love that feeling. I guess if you live there long enough, it starts to maybe dull a little bit.
But, yeah, yeah.
I love that feeling of dislocation.
Yeah, sometimes it can really, everything can feel so heightened. And, you know, almost hallucinatory at times, you know,
yeah.
as though you're microdosing some, like, particularly, mild, but vivid hallucinogen, you know, not that I've ever microdosed, nor would I ever advocate for such a practice.
I finally got around to doing it. I didn't do it enough though.
You heard it here first.
I mean, I didn't, it's like a sub psychoactive dose. So like, I don't know what happened.
I have to admit, and I hope that this is not revealing too much about me. But for a long time, I really refused to see the point of microdosing. You know, my feeling about microdosing was always, look, if you're going to take the drug, you know, why not take it in a way that will actually allow you to sort of hallucinate? I mean, isn't that the kind of the whole idea?
Well, but I think that there are medicinal possibilities for...
Oh, I'm sure there are.
Like, there's a book by, I'm going to forget her name. She's married to Michael Chabon. I know that's like a reductive way to refer to somebody.
Waldman.
Iolette Waldman.
Iolette Waldman,
and she
exactly.
wrote a book called A Really Good Day, I think. And it's mm-hmm. about her struggle with mental illness, depression, and like taking these SSRIs and not having success with them. I mean, I'm probably butchering the details, but basically started taking microdoses of either psilocybin or LSD, and then basically kept a diary and published this book. But
I heard about that.
I think there's a lot of exciting possibilities for the microdosing in that department, especially since I think I'm very mistrustful of the long-term effects of SSRIs. Like there's like studies showing that they can cause dementia.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to like, for people out there who need SSRIs and who are taking them, like I'm not a doctor.
Yeah.
I'm just a skeptic, you know.
And we are sitting here drinking two fairly stiff glasses of bourbon, which I'm sure can also cause dementia.
I've had a long week. Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah.
Although I once gave my father, who was quite a drinker, a hard time for having an extra bottle of beer. And I was probably 14 at the time, and he was, I don't know, 54, and a physician. And I said, you know, Dad, you really want to think about the fact that you're killing brain cells by drinking that extra bottle of beer. And he looked at me with such contempt, you know, the kind of contempt that only like a career drinker can have for someone telling them not to drink. And he said, son, breathing kills brain cells.
By the way, that's not just drinker. It's physician.
Yeah.
Like I found some of the people in my life that I've known who have been the most kind of callous or like, what's the word I'm looking for? Like unconcerned about shit like that.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Are people in the medical profession.
Oh yeah. My dad, you know, I don't think my dad ever took me to the doctor in my entire childhood. You know, like I would have an incredibly high fever. My mom would be freaking out somewhere and he would just be like, just good for the immune system. You know, he'll get through it. You know, like it was really strange because he himself was a hypochondriac.
Oh.
It was quite an interesting double standard there.
Okay. So where are you, let's get to your, origins. Where are you from?
Well, as I said, my dad comes from a long time California family. My mom is Austrian from a town a couple hours south of Vienna. They're both scientists. They were both cancer researchers. And they met at an international medical congress in Vienna at the end of the 60s. My dad was quite a bit older. He was sort of the keynote speaker at this congress. He was a childhood leukemia specialist. And my mom was sort of fresh out of her PhD program. And he managed to dazzle her, which he also often attributes to a three-piece Madras plaid suit that he was wearing at the time. And if she also claims he was wearing some sort of silver tennis shoes, I don't know. My father does not have a very good sense of style. And this just sounds far cooler than he could ever possibly have been. But he somehow convinced her to leave her family and leave Austria and come to the United States. And they both worked for the National Institute of Health in Washington, D.C. In the 70s, which is where I was born. But I only lived there for a year. And then we all moved up to Buffalo, New York on the Canadian border.
No shit.
Near Niagara Falls.
Buffalo.
Yeah. Buffalo, New York, yeah.
I think of Buffalo, I think it's just freezing cold.
You know, that's a popular misconception about Buffalo. Buffalo gets a ton of snow.
Okay, that's what it is.
But it's actually much less cold than a town like Chicago, let's say, or Cleveland. Not that those aren't extremely cold cities in the wintertime.
Yeah.
But the reason Buffalo gets so much snow is that it's surrounded by water on two sides. And in the early winter, Lake Erie has not yet frozen over. So this water vapor kind of rises up into the air and then turns into snow and then dumps itself on Buffalo.
So what are we talking about? How many feet of snow?
Buffalo gets a lot of snow in the wintertime. It's actually a wonderful place to spend Christmas, because often you'll have 3 feet of snow, four feet of snow at Christmas time.
Yeah.
Now, I should say that I left Buffalo when I was 17 years old and have always kept my visits back to an absolute minimum. But that has nothing to do with the weather.
You got family back there still? Or?
My mom, strangely enough, although she grew up in Austria, as I've said, and often talks about going back to Europe, you know, now that she's retired. My mom's really... my mom has a real soft spot for the underdog. Twiggy, behave yourself now. but he, you know, I guess Twiggy heard underdog and is weighing in.
I have her trained to bark whenever somebody says underdog.
I wasn't talking about you, Twiggy. I can tell you're an overdog. No, my mom just, I don't know. She's become this real advocate for Buffalo and champion of Buffalo, because Buffalo is a town that really gets dumped on by the whole country. It started with Johnny Carson in the 70s.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it became a joke. You know, he would always get the weather report and you'd see like 3 feet of snow in Buffalo. And Buffalo just became synonymous with a depressed Rust Belt town that had shitty weather that no one would ever want to live in.
Yeah.
Which was true at the time, that, you know, the town was really in a tough spot. But it's become a far more pleasant place to live in the intervening years.
Well, I'm from Milwaukee and Indianapolis.
Okay. You know, Milwaukee's a lot like Buffalo.
Yeah.
The first time I was in Milwaukee, which I think was in 2002, I was on a weird little book tour for my very first book with Colson Whitehead. I was sort of Colson's opening act.
Oh, wow.
I made him look good, you know, with my awkward just attempts to read from my book.
Like the shaky book.
Like, yeah, yeah. I really was. I was like, you know, I was like the hack comedian that the headliner sends out to loosen the crowd up or what have you. But I remember we were both in Milwaukee, and I thought it was just so beautiful, and I really felt at home there. Milwaukee has these amazing old houses, and it's a town that was really wealthy in the early decades of the 20th century, just exactly like Buffalo.
Hmm. Just like a port town, or
yeah, you know, I mean they were both, I think, how should I put this? The success of both of those towns was directly related to their location on the banks of one of the Great Lakes, you know? Milwaukee was much farther west. So, you know, maybe Milwaukee was sort of earlier on in the kind of chain of trade that kind of led from the Midwest through the Great Lakes and then along the Erie Canal and eventually the Hudson River and then New York City or across to Boston. And Buffalo was right at the beginning of the Erie Canal, which for a few decades was the place to be in terms of trade and commerce of all kinds.
Hmm. It's interesting to me how like these places can, you know, just like the rise and fall of empires and cities. Yeah. And like, I was talking to
quick. It can be quick.
Well, yeah. I was talking to a buddy of mine this week who has been traveling for like 6 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And has been all over the country. And I was like, so where you been? And he's like, oh my God, you know? And I said, well, what were the highlights? And he said, like, one of them was like Oklahoma and the other one was Detroit.
Oh yeah.
And we started talking about Detroit. I read a book called The Unsettlers by John Sundin,
uh-huh.
which is about people who kind of like not go off the grid, but basically drop out of the system.
Right.
Try to reinvent themselves and find like, you know, sort of new economies.
Yeah.
And Detroit's like a perfect sort of like tabula rasa for that sort of behavior.
Yeah.
Because it just got completely obliterated. But you talk about a place that went from being what, the third or fourth biggest city in the country at mid 20th century.
Sure.
And even like when I was a kid, mm-hmm. I mean, Detroit and like the auto industry was, you know, like way, I think it was on its way out at that point, but I think it was still much closer to its prime.
And but also with an unbelievably vibrant culture as well.
Yeah.
I mean, if you just want to look at music, you know.
Right. Motown and the whole thing.
Yeah, unbelievable stuff. Chess Records, Motown. So much of the best popular music that's ever been recorded in the United States was recorded in Detroit.
And it just, like, you know, past 20 years.
Yeah.
Obliterated.
Mm-hmm.
Or more than 20, but I mean, you know what I'm saying? Like it really sort of like kind of manifested over these past 20 years. And
it's been more dramatic in Detroit than any of the other Rust Belt towns, you know?
Yeah.
I feel like a town like Milwaukee, you know, has had its hard times, but it was never just sort of atomized and just devastated the way Detroit was, you know, which of course now makes Detroit one of the more interesting towns to visit.
Isn't it? No, it's interesting. Like whenever there's like, I remember like, you know, Prague had its moment in the late 80s, early 90s, where it's like, A, it's cheap.
Right.
You know, but like whenever there's like the fall of an empire or like a revolution of some kind, it's like, go there soon after.
Yeah.
You know, and it's always like an interesting place to be.
Sure.
And like, I guess, you know, after the crash or when a place has been obliterated, you have an opportunity for reinvention.
Sure.
The real estate's cheap.
Yeah.
And I think too, people get a chip on their shoulder. People love their hometowns. Like your mom loves Buffalo and like people who are from Michigan.
Yeah.
They have a vested interest in seeing it rejuvenated.
Right.
And then there are people I think who go there and make it home and like want to participate in something like that. And I find that relatable.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. It's exciting too, to feel as though, an entire urban center has been laid to waste, you know, and you know that something's going to spring up again. And it may bear no relation to what was there before, but, you know, that's what's so fascinating about a city like, say, Rome, you know, which saw successive waves of development and over again would reach these heights and then implode or be invaded or be sacked, you know. I mean, the city of Rome that we know now came about after centuries of essentially existence as a ghost town, you know, after the fall of the Roman Empire. You know, there was a period of time when the city of Rome was really, you know, was overgrown by trees and vines and was almost just a colossal ruin.
Hmm.
And the same is true for Mexico City. I mean, living in Mexico City as I do now, it's amazing. You can forget for even days at a time that the modern city that you're living in, the more or less modern city there, was literally constructed on the ruins of the most ancient city in this entire half of the planet. But then again, you'll round a corner thinking of something completely different, and suddenly there's some jet black pyramid in front of you at the end of the street that's just, you know, built out of volcanic rock and that's been at the end of the street, obviously before there was that street, but for thousands of years. And it's incredibly thrilling when those moments where you really feel as though, you're seeing through these layers, these sort of various sheets of reality to a, to an underlying story that's kind of been there all along, but that you didn't even notice. If you're looking the other way when you turn that corner, you wouldn't even have seen that tiny little pyramid at the end of the street. Mexico City is really a fascinating place to be.
I think that's the microdose talking right there.
I know, or maybe a little bit more than the microdose. I forgot to mention that I dropped acid before coming here today.
Sheets of Reality was the cue.
Yeah. No, that's the title of my memoir, actually.
So let's talk about you as a writer. Like, you grew up in Buffalo.
Yeah.
You sure seem like well-educated. Like, you had a good like upbringing, education, smart parents.
Sure.
Went to, where'd you go to school?
Well, my parents valued education a lot. I did have some problems. I think I've dropped out of school three times in the course of my education, but I eventually did stick it out. I went to Oberlin College in Ohio, which is a wonderful place. I think everything good about who I am as an adult probably happened as a result of the 4 years that I spent in that little town in the middle of Ohio.
Hmm. Why? What was it?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, you know, Buffalo, when I lived there, was not the most progressive place to be. You know, I don't think I knew a single human being who was openly gay, for example, until I got to college. And that's, I mean, you know, for the first 17 years of my life, not a single person.
Yeah.
It's impossible to imagine now.
Right.
I mean, it's impossible.
Yeah.
I don't even believe it myself, you know, thinking back on it. But that truly was the case for me. And Oberlin, which I went to simply because it was academically the best school that I got into. I had terrible grades in high school. Was, and I think still is, one of the most progressive colleges in the country. It was commonly referred to as the gayest school in America when I got there, around the time that I went there. And that was, just that in and of itself was the best thing that could have happened to me. You know, it was a very steep learning curve for me in the first month or two that I was in college. I mean, I remember being shocked by someone openly acknowledging the fact that they masturbated. I was completely shocked by that. It was just some guy a year older than me who was living in my dorm in my same hallway. I can still physically feel my shock and surprise that was something that you were allowed to own up to, you know?
Right, right.
And I really can't blame my parents for this, you know? My mom was very, was this sort of 60s generation, you know, almost a little bit too sexually liberated for my comfort.
Right.
You know?
Right.
I distinctly remember being in a car with my mom. We were going to the supermarket, I think, and I was about halfway through high school, you know, maybe I was 16 years old. And my mom, we stopped at a red light. She reached over, opened the glove compartment, and inside the glove compartment was a box of condoms. And she said, "John," you know, in her very thick Austrian accent, you know, she said, "John, I know that you're having sex already, and I think it's a beautiful thing that you're having the sex. It's a wonderful thing between any two people. I just want you to understand the importance of prophylaxis, you know." And that really was one of the most humiliating moments of my youth, because I was so far from having sex.
Right.
I remember thinking, God, even my mother thinks I'm having sex already. So it wasn't her fault. It wasn't my parents' fault. But I think just that part of the country at that time, it really makes me feel kind of old, because our values have changed so much and so many things have gone so horribly wrong with this country. But we are more open than we used to be. And obviously, you know, socially speaking, human rights have advanced. And anytime that I'm incredibly down about where we are as a country, I think back on, you know, just how closed Buffalo was when I was growing up and how no one was openly gay, at least that I knew. And just how far we've come in that regard. And it makes me a little bit less depressed.
I feel similarly. I had similar blind spots, you know, and like lived in kind of a cloistered, you know, I mean, Indianapolis back in those days.
Yeah. Probably a lot like Buffalo.
Yeah. I mean, in Milwaukee too. But, And then I had a similar like awakening in college. I went to Boulder and was just like, oh.
Yeah.
Okay.
College is pretty great.
I think so too.
I mean, if you're lucky enough to go somewhere good, yeah.
And also just like not even, I mean, academically, but also just socially, to be someplace where, you know, you can be at liberty.
Yeah. No, it's the greatest gift.
So did you know?
I couldn't wait to go to college.
So did you go into Oberlin feeling like you were interested in writing, or did you become a writer as a result, or did it even happen later than that?
Well, I started writing fairly young. I was fairly precocious with writing, but it was sort of an interesting evolution because my mother read an enormous amount. My dad read a lot. When I was about 10 years old, I was trying to write things. And then I had I don't know what to call it. Basically, what happened was I was reading a lot of mystery novels and thrillers. I decided I was going to write a whodunit, you know. And I knew my parents were kind of into that sort of genre of fiction, so I thought I was going to impress them with this thing. So I wrote the first chapter was probably only a few pages long. I didn't have much of an attention span in those days. But I remember the premise was, which is ripped off from somebody, probably Agatha Christie or something. The premise was that this wealthy old man in this small town had been murdered. But everyone hated this person so much that everyone had a wonderful motive to kill him, you know, so, which I, you know, not the most original idea, but, I think I probably stole that from Murder on the Orient Express by Agatha Christie. Now that I think back on it. Anyway, the first sentence of my novel, which at that point was 5.5 pages long and never became longer than 5.5 pages, was, I think I can still remember it. Old Man Withers was, without a doubt, the most ornery old fart in the village. So I gave my parents these 5 pages and, you know, very impatiently waited for them to read them and get back to me. And, you know, a few days later, we sat down and I very eagerly and impatiently asked them what they thought. And I'll never forget what they said. My father said, "John, your mother and I are very, very pleased that you're pursuing this can I call it a vocation? This vocation, you know, we think that, you know, what you've written shows a lot of promise and we're very pleased that you shared it with us. But are you sure you want to use the word fart in the first sentence of your novel?" And that really traumatized me. It really burned me more than it should have. I mean, I think in retrospect, my father was right. But what that meant to me at that age was these adults don't take me seriously and they don't take what I'm trying to do here seriously. And then it hit me how long it would probably take, how far I was from a point at which I could write a novel that people would take seriously. I mean, it's kind of sad in a way. Even at 10, I was desperate to be taken seriously. What kind of ambition is that for a 10-year-old?
Right.
But then I completely stopped writing for 8 or 9 years. And only after I'd been at Oberlin for a while, which happens to have a really wonderful creative writing program, did I eventually start to notice that some of the kids that I knew were writing probably poems or things like that that seemed to almost be taken seriously. And once I realized that maybe we were at an age where that could be possible, what did I even mean? What did I even think that meant to be taken seriously? I'm not even really sure. But I've always felt a little bit of embarrassment about doing anything creative and asking anyone to take it seriously. But that really shut me down for almost 10 years.
Damn.
Yeah.
And then you got back on the train and started.
I was a sensitive soul. I was a hothouse flower in those days. Now I've got, you know... now I've got a soul wrapped in shoe leather, but you know, back in the day. Yeah. So then I started dabbling and, you know, I did the standard thing, took a couple creative writing classes, you know, where you have to try everything out, little one page plays and poem here and short story there. And I certainly read a huge amount. Both of my parents were big readers, as I've said, especially my mother. My mother, you could tell sort of halfway through dinner that my mother was impatient for dinner to be over so she could go to bed and open up her, whichever Penguin classic she was reading at the time. Like you could feel it. It was like this, you know, she kind of stopped listening to you after a certain point. And normally she was a very sweet and attentive woman, but when she was ready to go to bed and read her book, I mean, that was really when she most fully came alive. You know, I really think for a decade or two there, my mother lived most intensely when she was curled up in bed with her reading glasses on and one of those big fat Penguin classics with the orange spine open in front of her on her lap. And I must have noticed that or taken that in some way. I've always read a ton my whole childhood, even when I was doing terribly in school, even when I was not in school, when I dropped out. I feel as though I was never not reading. And I'm sure that's true for most writers. It's probably the only thing that's really crucial. Without reading an enormous amount, I can't imagine anyone, being able to write very well. As far as education, I think that's the only thing that you need. I think it doesn't really matter where you went to school or if you went to school. But you have to have that very, not just the pleasure in reading, but that kind of greediness about it, you know, a greedy excitement that leads to like really close attention.
I have to correct my dog real quick.
Twiggy, no.
What are you doing over there, Twiggy?
So what about like writers, like what were some books? Like were there formative experiences for you reading that like,
oh, sure, yeah.
Like made you like say, like, I want to do this. Like that.
Yeah, absolutely. Different books at different times in my life. When I was very small, I was really passionate about Through the Looking Glass, which is the second installment of Alice in Wonderland by Lewis Carroll. I was never that into Alice in Wonderland for some reason, but I loved Through the Looking Glass. It just has a slightly different tone. To me, it has a slightly darker, more kind of, you know, Alice in Wonderland, of course, has this dreamlike quality to it, but Through the Looking Glass has a darker tone that to me is really more accurate to, you know, in terms of what dreams feel like to me. I just loved Alice in Wonderland Through the Looking Glass. And I still read it, every year in the summertime. There's an old beat up copy at my mom's house. And when I'm visiting in the summer, I'll open that and read it. Later, I got incredibly into The Lord of the Rings. Like every other kid in the world, you know? So I would really be lying if I didn't say that The Lord of the Rings, especially I think, The Two Towers, which is the middle of the trilogy. I can't think of a book probably that had a stronger influence on me. Then later I became very passionately interested in science fiction and mystery novels right at exactly the same time. Even though I really do think as genres, they're not that closely related to one another, but you know, back in those days, there weren't that many, sort of hybrid novels, that combine the two. Now, of course, it's a very common thing. But so there may be some books like, Childhood's End by Arthur C. Clarke.
I love that one when I was a kid.
Yeah. I absolutely loved all the Raymond Chandler novels, although I really think I was too young to understand a lot of the humor in them, but there was something about that style. It was both very hard boiled and kind of baroque in a certain way, because he, you know, Raymond Chandler will write the strangest sentences just to get a kind of chuckle out of you. You know, he's really a kind of very dry, very arch, very alcoholic comedian, you know? and then later, I remember in high school, there were a number of books that we were assigned to read in English class. They were hugely, that really got me, that really kind of knocked me sideways. Winesburg, Ohio by Sherwood Anderson was a book that I just adored. Fathers and Sons by Turgenev for some reason. The Sun Also Rises was a big book for me. I also went through a period of really obsessively reading all of Ursula K. Le Guin's books. She was sort of the last science fiction writer that I became really passionate about. Then I got to college and, you know, a lot of the kind of, probably a lot of the standard books that book geeks get excited about in college, like Gravity's Rainbow or Italo Calvino. I remember there's a novel by Italo Calvino called If on a Winter's Night a Traveler that is probably not his best book, but somehow that one really got me. It had the conceit that each chapter was a slightly different literary genre and that each chapter kind of linked up with the next, even if they were totally unrelated in terms of plot or subject matter. And at the very end of that novel, the various chapters with their various titles sort of create a story within a story that's just a paragraph made of little composite pieces of all the different things you've read. So it was a very, you know, a very postmodern book that at that time, at that age, you know, when you're 20 years old, just seems like, you know, the whole artifice of it and the trickiness of it and the cleverness of it seems like the very highest thing that literature could aspire to.
You know? Yeah. I have a friend who loved that book.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, I mean, nowadays I would probably say The Baron and the Trees is my favorite Italo Calvino book because it somehow has a bit more kind of heart to it maybe than some of his drier experiments and literary games.
Now, what about getting from, you know, college and being a book geek to actually trying to write your own book and finally be taken seriously?
Well, it's an ongoing process, Brad.
For you and me both.
After college, I didn't quite know what I wanted to do with myself and had a couple peripatetic years where I lived in Alaska for a while, lived in Texas for a while, which was very important for me actually living in Texas because Mexico was so close and that really kind of educated me about a lot of things to go back and forth and cross that border a lot.
Where in Texas were you?
I was in Austin for a while. I was in San Antonio for a while. And then at the very end, I lived in a very tiny town called Terlingua, which is right next to the entrance to Big Bend National Park. And it's really just across the Rio Grande from Mexico. And at that point, the Rio Grande is almost just a trickle. You can literally just take your shoes off and wade across into Mexico. And that was a pretty extraordinary time that
How
I think back
there?
On a lot. How long was I in Terlingua? Not even half a year. I'm still not exactly sure why I stayed. Oh yeah, I remember now. It's a tiny town of about 100 people. And I can feel pretty small pretty quick.
Did you go there to like try to hide away and write?
No, I wasn't trying to write at all when I was there. I was mostly just doing a lot of hiking and eating a lot of really great Mexican food.
Yeah.
And trying to find some kind of, in retrospect, completely imaginary idea of the kind of, not the far west, but like the deep west or the true west, you know, and just wanting to kind of, I really feel as though I spent whole months there just chasing ghosts, you know, which were largely just projections of my own God knows what.
Wow.
But it was a wonderful time. I'll never forget it.
And then what about like early attempts at books and getting yourself, finally getting yourself to where you're publishing?
I did start trying to write things towards the end of my time in college, but they were all very, very short things. I suppose you'd say poetry. I mean, most of the things I was writing were sort of these little compact paragraphs or a couple paragraphs, you know, prose poems, I guess is what you'd call them. Although I thought of them more as just very, very, very tiny little short stories. I would have written some longer things, but I just didn't have the attention span, you know, or the discipline to do it. And maybe my brain was still developing on some kind of, you know, neurochemical level. I'm not sure. I do know that the first time that I was able to begin writing something that would eventually, that actually eventually did become my first novel, there wasn't any sort of eureka moment or any kind of clear correlation between work that I had done or things that I had studied or even books that I had read and the ability to do it. It almost felt like some kind of biological shift in me, you know, that maybe my brain was done maturing in some way, and then I could just do it. I mean, certainly the most important epiphany for me was really if you came up with even just three characters who were distinct from one another and wanted things from one another and also hated one another in some way, that was enough of an engine to drive an entire book-length narrative, you know? Just if you have these characters that seem plausible to you, maybe even real to you if you're really lucky, you can kind of just put them in a petri dish and let them interact. That's a terrible mixed metaphor, but we'll just go with it. And they may, if left to their own devices, sort of at least not write a book for you, but create enough of a kind of, I suppose, they'll generate enough plot that you can, you know, if you find the right way to serve that material, you know, you might end up with a book. I mean, it's probably rose-tinted goggles here now looking back on it, because I think it was a huge amount of work looking, you know, on a day-to-day basis. I think my two major epiphanies that made it all possible were what I've just described and also the very sort of boneheaded realization that a book is made out of pages and that writing a single page in a day is not really that much work. And then if you just do a tiny amount, maybe not even a page, but if you do a tiny little bit every day, in theory, at the end of a year, you'll at least have something that looks like a book. It'll be enough pages. You could theoretically call it a book, even if it's terrible. And that made things a lot less scary to me. It made it seem, I started to think of a book not as one 300-page monolithic kind of text sculpture and more as a collection of, let's say, 300 one-page mini stories.
But what about all the connective tissue and making it actually cohere?
Well, I didn't think about any of that stuff.
Details,
fortunately, because if I had thought about that, if I'd even known what that signified, I might never have gotten started.
But so that lets you get through the, you know, initial drafting process, but then,
yeah,
you know, on the revision, that's when you made all that other
stuff. Well, I didn't even really have a sense of what revision meant at that time. You know, I'm not the kind of person who plans things very well. And I just wanted to get started. I was at a time in my life when I began my first book, in which I had quite a string of rotten luck. I'd been fired from my job. I was living in New York City at the time, working at an art gallery. And I was fired from my job, kicked out of the sublet I was living in, dumped by my girlfriend, and, you know, had 4 years to go until I hit 30. Maybe had a slight substance abuse problem. Although that, I think that actually ended up taking care of itself when I found something to do with my time. But suddenly I found myself with no distractions and no way to justify not trying to write a book. And I'd felt like maybe I wanted to give that a shot for quite a number of years at that point. I had dabbled in all sorts of sort of creative pursuits over, I'd say between the ages of 13 and 23. I tried literally everything that came my way except maybe acting. I never tried acting. And I'd been pretty bad at all of them. And writing was something I was slightly less bad at, although I was certainly not someone... No one pointed at me and said, "Oh, this young man has promise." You know, it always felt like I was kind of trying to overcome people's doubts, but that might be a good thing. You know, I think it does. It makes you work hard.
Yeah, but it goes all the way back to your childhood.
It does. Yeah,
that's the through line.
I guess so.
But your parents seem like, because I always think like maybe I try to like sort of game out why I became writerly and wanted to like communicate and be heard and taken seriously. And I like the only way that I can like break it down is that, you know, when I was raised Catholic, it didn't really take for me, but I was sort of not punished, but just sort of it was frowned upon.
Mm-hmm.
And I was trying to say, like, hey, this doesn't make sense. You know, it was just that feeling. Just like when you wrote that story with the fart in the first line.
Yeah.
Where they're not listening.
Right.
And, man, that stuff stays with you. It had a powerful charge.
Yeah, it does. It does. My mom actually has been very supportive of my writing from the very beginning. But unfortunately, she's just sort of by nature, by temperament, a very pessimistic person who worries a lot, you know?
Yeah.
You know, she's a Central European mom. She has a lot in common with Jewish moms, I would say. As a matter of fact, my Jewish friends and I often sort of compare notes. And, you know, one of my closest friends, Nathan Englander, is convinced that my mom is secretly Jewish, you know. He wants her to take one of those 23andMe tests because right. He refuses to even consider the possibility that she's not actually Jewish because she really does fit fit that stereotype. She was always supportive, but never really believed that the world was going to not crush me, you know, because that's what the world does from her point of view. My dad was a little different. My dad was always more skeptical, very hard to impress, very sort of oddly competitive with me about that sort of stuff. And I never understood that until years ago, long after he had moved back to California.
Your parents split up?
Parents split up when I was in college. Which I was pretty happy about because they were fighting a lot and that's no fun, you know, for any kid to see. But I found a notebook of my dad's. It was actually an old accounting ledger, those sort of green, dusty covered accounting ledgers you used to be able to get in drugstores, you know.
Yeah.
Maybe you still can. In a drawer of his old desk. And I opened up this green ledger, and inside were poems.
Oh.
He'd been writing poems for years and years and years that he shared with no one.
Huh.
These very sort of metrically precise, very kind of old-fashioned sort of poems. I mean, I have no idea who his points of reference were as a writer. If I had to guess, I would say, you know, someone like W.H. Auden or something, you know, that sort of classic style, you know, that owes as much to sort of 19th century poetry as it does to modernism, you know. Well, I'm really making my dad's poetry sound like...
You're really selling it here.
I'm really selling it here. I'm really making it sound like a very serious endeavor. I'm sure it was serious for him. For the record, the poetry was terrible. Sorry, Dad.
He's a great doctor.
He's a good doctor, yeah. But it was interesting to me to have that discovery and to understand that maybe I was doing something that he might have enjoyed doing himself.
Yeah.
But he certainly never admitted that to me.
Huh. But I mean, like, your mom must be thrilled.
My mom is thrilled, yeah. My mom has always been sort of... I mean, I'm just going to say it. My mom has always been my biggest fan.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's what moms are supposed to be.
That's right.
Strangely enough, you know, again, she has this perverse kind of sympathy for the underdog. You know, my second novel is really of all of the five novels that I've read. I mean, before we go any further, I should tell you I've only read five novels ever. Did I mention when
that.
You asked me which books were important to me? I think I did mention five. Those are the only ones I've ever read.
Yeah.
No, of the five books I wrote, by far the least successful one and the one that no one read and the one that the few people who may have read did not understand or appreciate was my second book, Canaan's Tongue, which is a really nasty, dirty, violent, gross book. And it's my mom's favorite. I mean, it's about a gang of slave profiteers in the decades before the Civil War. They're horribly racist, evil people who are constantly, you know, perpetrating the worst forms of violence on rival gang members. And it's just really a bunch of absolutely loathsome human beings. And for some reason, this is the book my mom keeps mentioning as her favorite. I don't know what she's trying to really tell me when she says that to me. I'm still trying to figure it out. I'll probably never stop trying to figure that out. But she's always been great. My mom is really a very supportive person. And I don't think I've ever talked this much about my mom interview.
Your impression of her is dead on. I want to meet her. She sounds like it's like almost like Dr. Ruth Westheimer.
She's a little bit like Dr. Ruth. Her accent's kind of Dr. Ruthy. And
like, how old is Dr. Ruth? Because like she was a cultural figure.
She's very old.
She's got to be almost 100 years old.
I think she's in her 90s, but she's still kicking.
And spunky.
You know? Oh yeah. Oh, what a wonderful person Dr. Ruth is.
Yeah, I think she performed a very valuable function in art.
I think my mom would hate to be compared to Dr. Ruth because my mom is very
just the voice.
Well, that's exactly what she would hate. She'd be completely in favor of Dr. Ruth's take on sex and society, but my mom's very self-conscious about her crowd accent, which is still pretty strong.
Yeah. So let's talk about Godsend and John Walker Lind and, you know, how this all came to pass.
Sure.
Like, how did it come to pass? Like, what got you hooked into that story?
Godsend is actually a novel that has an origin story. I don't know if I'd be able to really explain the origins of any of the other books that I've written, but in the case of Godsend, it was pretty concrete. I went to Afghanistan in 2015.
On vacation or
no? No one goes to Afghanistan on vacation.
<I know. laughs>
At least not
spring
that I
break.
Saw.
It's like...
Well, you know, it was spring break. I wanted to cut loose. No, I went to. Wait, let me make sure I have the dates right. I went to Afghanistan in 2015 for Esquire magazine. I was supposed to write an article. Or I was trying to write an article about a warlord named Dostum, Dostum, who was an important member of the Northern Alliance, and an important ally to the United States in our war with the Taliban. I specifically was supposed to write an article about his sons. He has these three sons who are living the life of the international playboy. You know, they're spending all of their time in Zurich and Paris and Monaco, spending huge amounts of money, dating Ukrainian models. and their father is this tribal warlord, you know, who, as far as I know, has never even been out of the country.
This sounds like a sitcom.
It's quite an amazing story. And I think it would have made it an interesting article. But when I got to Afghanistan, Obama had just declared sort of mission accomplished in Afghanistan and had withdrawn all troops from the country. They were still present in the country, but they were confined to various military bases. So there was no U.S. military presence in the country anymore. I got there about a week after that. So it was this sort of calm before the storm. Everyone knew that the Taliban were going to regroup and start retaking the territory that they had lost as soon as the American and European military presence diminished. But my hope was that there would still be enough of a kind of lingering effect of the military presence there that I could get around. And I was able to go to a lot of places that you could not go to today, for example, anymore, with the help of a wonderful man named Noor, who works as a fixer in Afghanistan. He takes journalists and other sorts of operatives around the country. He's kind of a combination interpreter, guide, security expert, driver, and person who keeps you from going crazy and or getting your head cut off.
Yeah.
An amazing guy. He loves drinking whiskey. He loves Rihanna.
Who doesn't?
Who doesn't, of course. I mean, I've yet to find a part of the world where you can't at least find somebody who loves Rihanna. And that's as it should be.
That's right. Wait, what is my dog eating? I want to hear the rest of the story. Like, you're in Afghanistan, you're with, what's his name, your guide?
Noor.
Noor, yeah.
N-O-O-R. I'm not even allowed to say what his last name is. Not that it would matter. He wouldn't even allow me to take a picture of him without part of his face covered. But for good reason, actually.
Sure. But,
oh, God, I've had dozens of stories about him, each stranger and more amusing in its way than the last. But so I was trying to get to a part of the country that I was unable to get to. It turned out just to be impossible. There were all sorts of parts of the country that were in federal hands during the day, and that as soon as the sun went down, reverted into Taliban control. So that made it very tricky to travel, of course, because sometimes we were traveling very long distances, hundreds of kilometers a day. To make a long story short, we were unable to get to the parts of the country that I needed to get to write the article that I'd been sent to Afghanistan to write. But I wanted to go to Afghanistan for all sorts of reasons, among which the fact that I'd become very interested in the story of John Walker Lind, the so-called American Taliban, who for a few years after 9/11 was really quite infamous worldwide and certainly famous and very hated in the United States. So since we couldn't do what we originally had planned to do, we couldn't get to Doshtam and to the part of Afghanistan that he was in at the time, I decided that we should start investigating kind of the route that John Walker Lind had taken through Afghanistan in his time as a recruit and then later as a soldier in the army of the Taliban, and try to find people who had known him and ask them what their impressions were. And we had some luck with that, not as much as we'd hoped. But one day we were in a small town about an hour north of Kabul, and we were talking to this old man who was very chatty, very, very sociable, very willing to talk. And I asked him through my interpreter whether he had known the American boy who had served in the Taliban army. And he answered immediately, "Oh, yes, of course, I know all about the American boy. I know I could tell you all sorts of stories. And I also know about the American girl." And we were kind of, you know, we were all kind of shocked by that. And I thought he'd made a mistake. And actually, Noor also thought that he'd misspoke and tried to correct him and said, "Oh, I think you mean the American boy." And the old man was very firm and very clear. And he said, "No, no, no, I mean the American girl." And we ended up talking to him for quite a long time. And he gave us a certain amount of information. He claimed that there had been a girl who was either in her early 20s or in her teens, who at one point he insisted was American, and then at another point he described her as British. It wasn't entirely clear whether he knew the difference actually between the two. Who he claimed had been active in the armed forces, fighting in some capacity for the Taliban. But as I said, he was a little bit contradictory, and the information he gave us was sort of patchy. But we immediately decided that that was what we were going to try and get more information about in the few days that were remaining. This was kind of towards the end of my time there. And we managed to find some other people who had at least heard rumors about this supposed girl. But at the end of my time in Afghanistan, I realized I had nowhere near enough reliable information to write an article, let alone, I don't know, a nonfiction book about this subject. And I really felt that a book was what it deserved, because what a bizarre story to hear.
Yeah. I mean, John Walker Lind alone.
Right.
But, I latched onto that too. I remember when that was in the news, and you know, what was that? 2003, 2004. When I'm trying to.
Well, John Walker Lind was actually taken into custody, only 3 months after 9/11.
Oh, really? Okay. So yeah, so it was right after.
Yeah. But he was in the news for a long time because, at first they were trying to try him as a terrorist, which eventually, was shown not to hold any water at all, because at the time that John Walker Lind had joined the Taliban weren't even on the State Department's lists of enemies of the state. Hmm. We were actually trying to negotiate a deal with them to run a pipeline through the country from Uzbekistan down to Pakistan to where we could get our oil tankers to. You know, I mean, we were trying to do business with the Taliban. We weren't trying to fight them. Yeah. It was only 9/11 and when it came out that they'd been sheltering Al-Qaeda that they became enemy number one for the U.S. and we declared war on them. So this was a kid who just found himself really in the wrong place at the wrong time. I mean, I can't even think of another example that so perfectly illustrates how quickly global alliances can shift in our modern era. Obviously, there are millions of refugees who would serve as an excellent illustration of that as well. But what makes John Walker Lind interesting is that he was just a regular kind of upper middle class kid from Northern California, not of Muslim background, who converted to Islam, gradually became radicalized, but never had, as far as anyone can determine, any sort of intention of waging war against the United States or against American nationals. He just thought he was fighting in a Muslim army to protect a very idealistic and very morally upright state from aggression on the part of various warlords and bandits, essentially. The group of people who later came to be called the Northern Alliance. I mean, this is a very involved and not very articulate history lesson, but at the end of my time in Afghanistan, it was very clear to us that I didn't have enough even to write an article. And I had to tell my editors at Esquire that I was going to be coming back to the U.S. really without anything to show for my time. But at some point, it kind of hit me that I'm really not a journalist, first and foremost. I'm a novelist. And the way to do what I had learned in Afghanistan justice was so clear. And that, in fact, the gaps in what I knew about this American girl who had fought with the Taliban, who may very well be apocryphal. This just may simply be a legend. You know, so many legends spring up in wartime.
Sure.
But those gaps were kind of an advantage for me because that was the place where the novel could kind of begin.
And then here we are.
And then here we are, Brad.
Well, it's just, it seems like a story and subject matter, and this happens often, I think, especially with people who I think are, who are deeply invested in literature, who read a ton, and who just have a lot of natural talent and a good antenna is like the way I usually phrase it. But, you know, you've written a novel that I think speaks to the present moment, even though it's recalling something that happened almost 20 years ago. And that is like, how does a person become radicalized? And how do you take somebody who, you know, in one context, like you said, normal suburban kid from like Marin County, wasn't he? Like John Walker Lind?
That's right.
And then all of a sudden he's in the middle of nowhere in some village in Afghanistan fighting for an Islamic army. You know, like just,
yeah.
Talk about an adventure. Talk about a kid who wanted to be taken seriously.
That's right. The like, ultimate example of a kid who wanted to be taken seriously.
Yeah, but it's just, I don't know. I feel like there's a lot of resonance, and I don't know. I can't imagine that was like intentional, you know, that you were trying to say something about the moment that we were in or headed towards.
But well, that's so hard to do and so dangerous to try to do.
Yeah.
You know, I think all I was doing was trying to do right by a fragment of information that I'd been lucky enough to hear and that I thought might make a good novel and just might make a good yarn, really, you know? I certainly never really thought about the political implications other than trying very hard not to contribute to all the misrepresentations of Islam that already abound in popular culture in this country. You know, I think it's good to have a little bit of fear in you when you're writing a novel about adding to all the various distortions that are peddled for commercial reasons or simply because a writer might be a little bit lazy or might be willing to avail him or herself of various preconceptions that the reader might have. It can make your job a lot easier as a writer if you avail yourself of the preconceptions we all have. You know, it can save you a lot of work. You know, you can paint with a broad brush, very quick strokes. And, you know, if you're writing about a Nazi, I mean, you don't really have to say very much. You know, right. You say they're a Nazi. We all have this kind of idea of what a Nazi was, mostly probably through watching Hollywood movies or something, you know, probably some of that might be accurate. Some of it might not be. And if you say Muslim terrorist, everyone has an image that comes to mind that maybe they got from CNN or maybe they got from Fox or, you know, if they're really unfortunate, they got from John Updike's novel Terrorist. And, you know, what I think keeps a writer from not being lazy in that way is the fear of writing something that's going to become part of the problem. It's very easy to do that.
Yeah. You can do that even when you have better intentions.
Absolutely. Yeah. You can do that if you're just writing about, you know, 20-somethings dating in New York. You know, you can become part of the problem any old way. You can contribute to distortions and misrepresentations of the way things are, no matter what you're writing about.
Well, I don't think you did that in your book. And it's been a joy to talk with you. You're a great talker and a live mind. And I just appreciate you. For people listening, there's been a lot of scheduling mishaps trying to get this conversation in place. And John has been extremely kind in, you know, accommodating my crazy schedule. So appreciate
it. Well, Brad, I heard you had good bourbon.
Yeah, right. By the way, we're recording this on a Friday night. I don't know if you can hear it in my voice, but it's like bourbon, a long week, but a very excellent conversation, and I appreciate it.
Great way to start the weekend. Thanks, Brad.
Okay, that is John Ray. His new novel is called Godsend. It's available from Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. John Ray, great conversationalist, and one of our better writers, for sure. Go get his book. Again, it is called Godsend, out there from FSG. If you want to find him on the internet, it's johnray.net. He's on Twitter at John_Ray. I sort of like the... I feel like I have more gravitas with this cold. I don't know. My baritone. Is it a baritone? I don't even know what it is. Thanks to Kill Rock Stars, as always, and the band Stereo Total for the theme song music. Thanks to Tiger in My Tank for the theme song music. Or the interstitial music, is what I mean to say. If you want to email me, the address is letters@otherppl.com. If you want to support the show, patreon.com/otherpplpod. Don't forget about the free Other People app. It's free. Go get it wherever you get your apps. And remember, with this new LitHub partnership, nothing changes. A new episode of the Other People podcast airs every Wednesday. It's free. You can get it on iTunes, Stitcher, iHeartRadio, wherever you get podcasts. The show's official website remains the same, otherppl.com. The show's Twitter, @otherppl. It's all the same. It's just, it's also going to be on LitHub. And we're going to join forces. That's what it is. It's a joining of forces. So my son has this cold. My wife has this cold. I apparently now have this cold. It's okay. I feel okay. I'm just like a little weary, but whatever. Just kind of annoyed. I feel like I get sick right around Christmas. That's like my time. That's when I like let myself get a cold or something. Not that I have control over it, but you know what I'm saying. It's like seasonal affective disorder. So I don't know what it is. It's like something, it's tied to Christmas. I'm blaming Christmas. It's the war on Christmas. Who's the John Walker Lind of the war on Christmas?